you can help solve a mystery. That's right, folks. It's your favorite... It's your sixth favorite Unsolved Mysteries podcast. The Stack Pack. I can't believe I've never made that joke before.
They ran out of stuff to listen to. Like, I guess we're not listening to a new one.
Because I listen to these annoying guys. The one guy who... Fuck, what did the girl say about me that I don't...
I don't know. They say
you're not aware.
We lack self-awareness.
The one host with the lacks self-awareness.
And one of them called me bisexual because they said I could go either way.
Oh, yeah. Oh. You're serious and annoying. Oh, gosh. Yeah, only leave us 5-star reviews, guys.
Oddly enough, those are the two things I look for in a man.
Your sixth favorite mediocre Unsolved Mysteries podcast. Hey, we're making some lists, though. I've seen some lists. I often Google like Unsolved Mysteries podcasts, and we're on there. there's people writing about us.
You know what's weird is I notice on Spotify that there's a podcast that's literally called Unsolved Mysteries, and I'm like, that they're counting the days until they get that cease and desist because Unsolved Mysteries is literally launching a podcast in January. Podcast.
Yeah,
and I'm just like, what do these guys think they're doing?
I don't know.
But anyway, yeah, so today we're covering Netflix's Volume 2, Episode
5.
I keep getting the numbers mixed up. This is Lady in the Lake, and wow.
Thank God you're not counting our ballots.
You literally made that joke last time. Like, you said the exact same thing.
Just reopening that can.
Someone would have written a letter if I didn't. We would have sent it to our P.O. box.
Is it the the same one that used to send us letters to Stick Stickley?
Yeah. For some reason, I was thinking of Nickelodeon Studios in Orlando, Florida. In Orlando, right, Florida, to too.
Stick Stickley. P.O. Box 963. New York City. New York State.
Oh, it's
10108.
Oh, and Stick Stickley was in a New York stick. Dang.
Yeah, it was New York stick.
And the whole rest of the operation was up there in Orlando.
Orlando.
Anyway, yeah, so Dead Lady. So, yeah, at first, when I watched this episode, I was like, this is interesting. And then we all kind of did a deep dive. Somebody early on after it aired sent us an Instagram message that had a big article that had, it was like all the things that Unsolved Mysteries leaves out.
And those details are juicy.
Juicy.
Oh, yeah. This one.
Like,
this,
if you like soap operas, this is it.
Yeah. This one has some really good meat on those bones, man.
Yes.
I see what you did there.
That's not a fat joke either.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. We also watched, and we'll put a link to it. It was like a local news station's, like, they did like a news special, like a half hour news special on.
Yeah, it was Detroit. It was
the Detroit.
Some local news outfit in Detroit.
It's pretty well done for like straight up local level news.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah, and there's a lot more information. And I mean, shit, we should just get into it. So this story takes place in Grosse Pointe Farms, Michigan, which is an affluent suburb. I'm going to use a Robert Stack word that isn't in the reboot, but it's an affluent suburb of Detroit. And it's like, yeah, just pretty much rich people. We're going to start our focus on the St. Paul Catholic Church. January 12th of 2010, a car is parked in front of the church. About 100 feet is a lakeside. The lake is called Lake St. Clair. So it's almost 10 PM. There's no reason for the car to be there. The cop goes to the vehicle. He sees the purses in the car, and then he finds footprints in the snow leading to the river, to the lake. Sorry. That immediately leads them to believe that there's somebody in the water, and they start a search and rescue operation immediately. The time frame is very weird. Should we just get into that right away?
Yeah.
Right off the bat, let's talk about how weird the time frame is.
It's super sus. The whole thing is just...
Yeah.
To me, right off the bat, even just watching the Unsolved Mysteries thing, I was like, I got questions.
Yeah.
I got lots of questions.
The first thing that's weird that I want to talk about, the cop actually runs the plates at 9:58. And but the daughters say that the cops arrived at 9:24 and told them that they found their mom's car and she was missing. Okay. And none of this is in the episode. Well, I mean, obviously them going to the cops is, but the time misconception is not in the episode. Another weird thing I want to say right off the bat is that the Lexus car was registered to Michelle, the daughter who tells most of the story. And yeah. She immediately thought that something was weird, that they were not looking for her, that they were looking for her mom when the car, because the car is registered to Michelle, not Joanne, the mom. So right. I just want to start off with all that shit.
So if she was missing, if Joanne was missing and they ran the plates on the car, they would think that it was Michelle driving, not Joanne. So they would be looking for Michelle, not Joanne. So when they came, that was already number one. So, and also you mentioned the 9:58. So they actually ran the plates twice. So at 8:58 first was Lieutenant Andrew Rogers. He ran the plates the first time, which I guess it's because it's an affluent area. I thought that was kind of weird.
And it's about like an hour after the prayer service would have been done. So,
right.
Yeah.
So like also like cleaning crews, like, I would think
cleaning crews don't drive Lexuses.
Yeah. But, and also it could have just been, she did say everybody knows everybody's business. Well, and like they just knew that the Lexus, that Joanne was using the Lexus, but who knows?
Right. Okay.
Yeah. But here's the thing is how quickly the situation escalates. Like, you know, the cop goes to the house saying that their mom is missing, but you can't file a missing persons report for 48 hours after the last known sighting.
Right.
So, how is she reported missing? If she was reported missing, she would have been last seen 48 hours prior.
Yeah.
Well, according to the chief, the reason that they thought that was because, which is also weird. So you we're going to have to like show a diagram or something. If you're watching this or if you're listening, you're going to have to like look it up in the visuals. So they see the car in the parking lot, which is the church parking lot. And then down very close.
It's like a parking lot slash driveway.
Driveway.
Like road out of the church. But it's still part of the church parking lot. There's parking spots there for the church.
So to me, it's like, okay, why would he even think to check down by the bankment? That's kind of, to me, was very suspicious as well.
Yeah.
So they said they saw footprints, which I don't see footprints. And then they said they saw handprints. I didn't see any handprints. I just saw like a mess. Like it just looked like somebody rolled something down there.
So the cop in the documentary, the local news documentary, he's like, like any cop just with basic intelligence that would see a car that's been there for just an hour wouldn't, like nobody would just immediately scour the area and assume that's, you know, something suspicious. Yeah, because it's been like, there for a couple hours.
Yeah, it's like, what if the person left it there overnight because, you know, the battery was dead or the, you know, it just wouldn't turn over. You know, so they're like, oh, you know, I'll just come back in the morning and tow it or come back in the morning with my mechanic. Like, you know, people leave cars in parking lots overnight all the time.
I didn't even think about the dead battery idea. Yeah, it could have been for any reason.
And especially like if they run the plates and they were like, oh, it's this person who's always at the church. I'm sure she got a ride home or something or whatever. I'm sure, you know, they wouldn't immediately until the family called, you know, they probably wouldn't have started anything on their own. Yeah, it's weird. So let's talk a little bit about Joanne Romaine because we just really jumped the gun and talked about what's weird.
I think
weird
we're just too excited.
Story. But I mean, I'm pretty sure everybody's seen the episode, so they're probably, you know, right with us. But all right, yeah. So what we know about Joanne Romaine is she has the two daughters and one brother. They were all in their 20s. They were all living with her. She had been married for 25 years. The relationship is kind of toxic and I guess just argumentative. And so she gets divorced and the husband was not happy. And she actually has to move in. In the documentary, they say that she moves in with her daughters.
With the Detroit documentary, not the Netflix documentary.
Yeah, not the local documentary. Yeah.
Also,
we'll be referring to that as the local documentary. And then
also what we did find out is that actually what happened is the husband actually left with Joanna's best friend.
Yeah.
That's the reason that they actually
she left Joanne major for her split. Best friend.
Yeah, that's just a no-no.
She was a great mom. She loved the kids. Like, she had a bunch of friends. She just went to church and hung out at people's houses and, you know, like, everybody loved her. And so when she's missing, it's like everyone starts to freak out, you know. They're calling around. They haven't heard it from her. They call up their uncle, John Matuk, who we'll get into.
Oh, yeah, we will.
He's very confused, and they just say that, like, okay, they say that mom's missing. You know, this is just very confusing. She's just like a normal church lady, cute little lady. Yeah, she's just like, you know, a little tiny, sweet mother type 55-year-old woman. The daughters say that that was the house that all the kids wanted to be at when they were growing up, and she got a lot of pleasure out of them hanging out and having a lot of friends and stuff.
It kind of reminds you of your mom.
Yeah.
Like your house.
She was a second mom to a lot of the teenagers in the neighborhood.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, she did own a liquor store, so.
A wine shop. It's a little more frou-frou, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, they called it a wine shop, but I think that that was actually a liquor store.
Great soul. Yeah. Great soul who sold spirits.
And goes to church and doesn't believe in suicide.
Yeah. So they show up to the church because that's where all the hubbub's going on, all the hullabaloo. And they see crime scene tape around the car. They're just like, what the hell's going on?
What was the word you used? Hubbubaloo?
The hullabaloo? The hubbub? I don't know. no malarkey.
Whatever it was. Whatever it was, I like it.
So they see the car parked in the driveway. The car is locked. The keys are nowhere to be found. There's no cell phone. The purse is in the car, and that made Melissa very
Which Michelle. Is weird though, because I told Dan in the documentary in Unsolved Mysteries rather, they show like the reenactment that when the police first hit up the car, he opens the car door and like literally feels the purse. So I guess Dan and I were just like, I guess that was like just a mistake that they made, and they just decided to leave it in.
Yeah.
Because when the daughters arrive, they do say that the car was locked, and I was like really – I even like went back. I was like, didn't I see the cop put his hand in there and touch his – yeah.
He did the George Costanza of, ooh, is that tweed?
They go more for the cinematic feel than the facts sometimes.
Yeah. Let me – is that Egyptian cotton?
Is that terry cloth?
Terry cloth?
So once they get to the scene, there's the family themselves scour the area. They look all around the church, and helicopter and dive teams, start to come out. But what we haven't said is the water was icy, but not frozen. You could see rocks sticking out of it because it was like 2 feet deep.
Kind of like a margarita that you order.
Yeah.
That you just kind of leave there.
Or just like a frozen one. Nicely shaken martini that still has like the little ice drips, the icicle bits on the top, you know? Yeah, like that. So yeah, it's like 2 feet deep, no current. She would have been floating, you know, she would have been easily visible. And they didn't find
had anything. She fallen in or jumped in. And so we also found out in like investigating that in 2010, the lake was a little more shallow. She would have had to walk in heels to football fields to get into any depth of water where she could have drowned.
Yeah, that's a crazy
little two matter. Football fields in heels.
Yeah.
For someone that's not in their peak physical performance is what one investigator said.
Very well put.
So they asked the cops like, what the fuck's going on here? And they're like, we think your mom just walked into the water. You know, just so it's like fucking makes no sense.
And the daughters are immediately no. They say, no, that's not my mom.
Yeah. There's no evidence. Like,
my mom would never just walk into the water like that.
They can't find any evidence that a crime occurs. All they see is the rocks and the butt prints, which the investigator so politically correct calls them butt prints. So 4 a.m., they finally call off the helicopters. And when they looked at the car, there was not a single clear fingerprint. But we also learned in the local documentary that the cops botched that shit hard.
Growing up, I used to watch a lot of Forensic Files. And one of the things I quickly learned is you can't fingerprint leather or like vinyl.
I didn't know that.
Because it has micro ridges, so you won't get an actual fingerprint because it's skin. That skin also has a fingerprint.
Skin.
Yeah. So what you do is you fume the vehicle with super glue. You take the super glue fumes and you fume it, and that adheres to the oils of the skin. That's essentially what the fingerprint is. Right. And then by casting light on it, it will glow with a UV light, and you photograph that. Mm. And that's how you lift fingerprints off of, you know,
leather.
Fake pleather or leather or vinyl.
It literally looks like somebody. That.
And it literally looks like, if you look at, we'll probably post the photo of the dusting of the car. It literally looks like a detective just took like a big, like family size jar of talcum powder and just went to fucking town.
That's exactly, I was going to say, it looked like somebody like tried baking a cake inside of the car and like sneezed into the baking powder. Or like flour.
I got like one of those things that you use to like feed your grass lawn with like the little crank.
Oh, yeah.
It just like spits the shit out every which way.
It was so messy. It was like, yeah. And then they're like, well, we couldn't find any usable fingerprints. Keep in mind, though, being an affluent area, also in Detroit, I don't know if they get a lot of like action like this.
But this is shit you should be learning in police academy.
Yeah.
Or at least when you become a detective, there should be like a course where they're like, hey, so dusting for fingerprints only works on hard surfaces such as glass and smooth plastics.
Well, yeah, it's 2010. Come on.
Well, that's what I was telling Dan. I was like, man, these little towns, doesn't it just seem like they're just, because there's not that much crime, that they just fucking suck at their jobs because there's just not that much shit like this that happens?
Yeah.
But they're part of a metroplex. So you know, they're part of the Detroit.
Well, when an idiot shows up and then he fucking opens the door, grabs the purse, and then closes the door, and then it's locked, and he's like, oh, it was locked the whole time.
that very well could have happened.
That's what Unsolved Mysteries is presenting, okay? Because maybe they didn't tell someone that the cop grabbed the purse. I don't know.
I don't know, man. But yeah, they totally botched that. It's so funny because like I can even like as we're talking see the picture in my mind.
Oh yeah,
just the dusting of the fingerprints all over.
Like you can literally in that photograph, you can see like where the fingerprinting did work, which was like the center console of the touchscreen, the outer door jamb of the door and the window. But then the rest, it just literally looks like fucking someone shot talcum powder everywhere.
I mean, literally, Dan has just said he's seen Forensic Files, and that's how he knows this. Like, he did not go to police school. He's not an officer. He's not in any sort of, like, law enforcement agency.
I think I even did a science fair experiment on fuming shit with super glue.
Oh my God.
Like my freshman year. I was a big nerd in high school.
Jackson is so pissed. Can you hear him?
Yes. Joanne worked at a boutique in town. And like we said, the whole town knew her. So the whole town kind of pitched in and was looking for evidence and trying to figure out what happened to her. But after this 3-day extensive search, they called it off. By this time, I mean, during the day, the water was completely clear. Like if there was something, it wouldn't have been hard for them to find it, you know?
Right.
The guy, one of the rescuers says, we found a lot of cold water, a lot of ice. It's like, oh, fuck off.
A lot of cold water.
I can't use any of this. that's what the documentary, the director is saying while this dude's talking about finding water and ice in a fucking lake in the winter in fucking Michigan.
In January.
Yeah. they could find no evidence that she was ever in the water. And they're not counting the butt prints. Another thing that she mentions, and you see it, is she would have to have waddled with her fucking high heels across the two lanes of traffic, a snowy median, and then over the street. But when they actually show the street, it's literally just like if there's a light there, you know, it would be kind of easy. But then they get into her walking down the embankment in the snow at that weird curve with all the snow. And then
at night also. And there's rebar. There was rebar at the edge of the water that was right there that potentially she could have gotten tangled up in.
Yeah, it's just weird. It's just weird. Mad's super snowy. The daughter says that she was super, super cautious. Like, she was a very careful lady. Like, it just doesn't make any sense that she would go down there.
Like, jump in for anything?
Yeah, no one in the family, none of her friends believed that she would do anything. That she would leave her kids on top of stuff like that, you know?
The only way that I could see something like that going down is if somebody was, like, maybe in the water or, like, something fell in there that was precious to her that she had to, like, go get.
I know.
But still, like a diamond-studded bangle?
Well...
she just seems like a bangle woman, all right?
Like a brooch with a bangle?
No, like the...
Oh.
Dangly like bracelets.
Bengal tiger?
I was picturing
like a Bengal tiger. I was
picturing a tiger brooch, like a big, a diamond sparkly brooch. It was like a tiger that she put on her, on a blouse, on a nice blouse. Oh, man. So, yeah. So she didn't take, any medications. There was no suicide note. But the police immediately.
They do also talk to her doctor also that. Multiple doctors that said that she was not mentally unstable. They don't think that she was suicidal. And they also note that they also, gosh, there was one more thing. They also noted that because of her Catholicism, they don't feel like she was the type to want to commit suicide, which they do talk about in the Unsolved Mysteries segment.
Well, we haven't really talked about how, this is a rich family. Like, they owned a wine shop. They're super loaded. So Michelle, the daughter, hires a bunch of fucking people, and we'll talk about all of them. The first guy is a guy named Salvatore Rastrelli. He's an investigative consultant, and he comes in after Michelle hires him. Like I said, apparently he's a water expert too, as well as being a PI. I don't know what the fuck that means.
Yeah, I don't either. I know how water works. Chaos theory.
He says this happens a lot where cops want to immediately assume that something's a suicide. I guess maybe it's easier, less paperwork, less investigation. I don't know. But he says that they'll always do this. They'll see something a little off and they'll just immediately jump to suicide. But he does his own investigation, which includes a lady with 4-inch heels walking down the same embankment, not in the snow. And she has a lot of trouble doing this, even with his assistance. But what's weird is just 5 feet down the way is like a little, like an easier way to get down there, almost like a, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then, well, she has to go down the embankment, and then there's like a drop, like a 4 or 5 foot drop. But, and that's what I meant, like four, like a couple of 10 feet, 20 feet away, you can see that there's like a, like a rock that's like on its side that she could, you know, you wouldn't have to fully go down the drop, but still it's like, if you're going to commit suicide, who cares about being careful? Right. But if she fell, there would have been the full, like, you know,
right.
A slide, you know, not just the butt print at the ledge.
So do you want to talk about also her events leading up to the night, like when the cops found her vehicle?
Yeah. Yeah. The first thing is 6 p.m. She drops off her son at home, right? She tells him she's just going to go get gas. I don't think she originally planned on going to the prayer, group. So she, at 6 p.m., she drops the son off. 6:25, she gets gas. The gas guy, Mike, knew her.
Like, gas guy, Mike.
Yeah. He fucking knew her. He's like, she's great. We talked about her kids. She left. Super normal, super cheerful. So the prayer service starts around 7:05. And I guess she decides to go to the church for the prayer service. Maybe it was on her way. The mom.
It's literally, they said it lasts 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And they did. The daughter, Michelle, says if she could make it, she would make it.
Exactly.
So, yeah. It's potentially like she went to go get gas, and she looked at the time and said, hey, I got time to stop and do this prayer vigil. It's going to take 15 minutes. I'm just going to pop in real quick, and I'm going to head out and go home.
And there was only like 10 or 15 people there in total. A witness put Joanne at the back of the church. And
so we hear from multiple witnesses at this point. Like, we're going to hear from a couple different ones.
Yeah. We should talk about a couple of them. So there's one witness who sees her in the back of the church. And these might be the same witnesses. Who knows?
There's who another, knows? Yeah, we don't know.
There's another witness who heard a car alarm, right? And yes. looked out the window and saw what they believed to be
the Lexus.
Lexus. They thought it was a Lexus.
And she says that Joanne left the church, right, when she heard the car alarm, right?
Yeah.
And then there's another witness who, when they left, she was the last person to leave around 7:35, I think she says, something around there. This is the interesting one, right? Because she leaves and she says that there was zero cars, including Joanne's Lexus or Michelle's Lexus, like we mentioned earlier. There was no cars parked there. So at right. which is interesting, which because this car left and came back.
Right. And we don't know why. There was also another witness that we find later that was not in the Unsolved Mysteries segment that apparently saw somebody who looked out of place. I don't know what that means. Running with a scarf.
Yeah.
And the police later find this scarf, which again was not in the in the Unsolved Mysteries segment.
A man running down the riverside in a scarf and a light jacket.
Yeah.
And he seemed out of place. We don't know what that means.
I mean, maybe he looked poor. Maybe he had shabby chic clothing.
Yeah, because affluent bunch of rich fucks that all know each other and they're all rich.
He could have been Mexican.
He's probably a Mexican. He's probably Mexican, and that's why I'm trying to blew up their beautiful red state. Well, not this time around.
Is Michigan red?
Not this year. I think
it's a swing. It's a swing state, right?
Oh yeah, baby.
Yeah.
It's usually red. Yeah, it goes both ways. Yeah.
Kind of like me.
Yeah, it's like you. It's like you're. So let's talk about hired gun number two. Bill Randall, retired FBI, also hired by Michelle. He says, you got to get your mom's phone records first and foremost. Boom. They do. What they find out is she's been making calls to a security company. And they think she was they say she thinks she was being followed. And the daughter says that maybe a couple months before her death that she seem more cautious. And
they say mid-December is what, when they interview the daughters, they say that in mid-December she was getting very skittish. Mm-hmm. And she said, people were following me. She said it wasn't always the same person.
That's true.
She said it was always somebody different.
Not she herself. She really felt
like somebody was following him. Which I don't know. I kind of want to believe them, but at the same time, I almost kind of feel like they're wanting answers. So they're kind of like grasping at straws. They just kind of want anything.
Yeah. So like, maybe she was weird, you know?
I don't know. I don't know the woman. I'm just going by just what I felt. I don't know.
They say they describe her as not herself and being very scared. A coworker from the boutique says that around January, she started getting these unusual calls that would take her out of the room. Like she would feel the need to like take the call somewhere else, which according to the coworker was very odd because she was usually pretty transparent, or just one of those annoying people who will talk on a phone in front of a bunch of people, which is super annoying.
I hate that. I hate that so much.
Yeah. Or the people that fucking put their phones on speakers should truly be sent to the depths of hell. Why do they think anybody wants to fucking hear that? Oh, cool. You have friends.
At the grocery store, you know I see somebody. It all the time. It's so annoying.
Oh, man.
Why do they have to prove that they're actually talking
What's to the difference
someone?
Between holding it like this in front of your face and holding it up to your ear? Like, it's like you're talking
this
like this on
my
speakerphone.
Fucking gears.
You guys are going
dude,
to hate
save
me.
Save ear, dude. God. The Stack Pack definitely does not approve of talking on a speakerphone. If you do that shit, stop, please,
you're gonna
because
hate
it's
me.
Annoying. What?
Do you do that? I do that at work.
That's so annoying.
At work.
I have to.
Dude, you're at work. You're not at the fucking grocery store in line.
What about, no. like, yeah, that's true.
Well,
what
because,
about,
like, I headset? Don't, like, I'm new to plumbing.
Where are your AirPods dead?
No, no, it's because, like, I'm new to plumbing, so, like, when they send me out on these, like, part runs, like, I don't know what the fuck I'm asking for, so, like, I show up to the place and I call, like, the person I'm assisting, and I go that's on speakerphone, I'm like, hey, so, Chris, I'm here with Chewy. What'd you want again?
That's way different. That's way different. That's 100% different because I don't want some weirdo on my phone. So yeah, I'd put him on speakerphone. But this is different. This is like gossip. Like I hear, oh yeah, and I told her.
That's
I told
a situation that woman. Where two people need to hear the phone, though, not when it's just one person. Fucking yeah.
Yeah. Oh God. Okay.
Yeah, we don't like that.
We don't like that. Nobody likes that. Stop.
Yeah, so Bill Randall gets the phone records. We don't really know too much, but she was contacting the security company, which is kind of vague, right?
So, yeah, do we know anything about this security company? Like, what do they specialize in? Was it like an alarm system kind of thing or what like?
It must have been private security, I guess, because she thinks she was being followed and stuff, you know?
Yeah. Like security detail, like I need somebody to follow me to make sure I'm okay.
She also thought somebody was fucking with her mail. She thought her phone was being tapped. These are all things that the security people told them, I guess, that they later found out. According to the daughters, the only place she felt truly safe was at church.
Which is ironic as fuck.
7:50 is the time that the witness places the scarf man running Lakeside.
And they said that she left at what, 7:30?
The 7:35 lady is the one who sees the empty parking lot. And then somebody at 7:50 saw a man running Lakeside around the area. I don't know if they were at the church. Probably not.
So I guess speaking of Scarf Man, apparently they you know, we have a witness that says this man, alleged man, we don't really know. Was running with a black scarf and light jacket, and the black scarf ends up being found by police.
Yeah.
And taken into custody and put in evidence in November of that same year. Police donated that scarf.
Oh, bless didn't their
they,
hearts.
Didn't they say 2015?
No, it was 20. It was, they took the deposition of the officer in 2015, but it actually, in November of 2010 was when they got rid of it. So not even a full year.
And the local doc, they're like, why would they do this?
Oh, yeah. It's still an open investigation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, in the local doc, because they don't even talk about the scarf man, which seems like a very interesting thing to add. There's another really interesting story that we'll get to that the episode doesn't get into.
We have another guy, another figure that we're going to introduce, another character, if you will.
March 20th of 2010, which was 70 days after she disappears, Joanne's body is found. Michelle gets the call. Two fishermen find the body on Boblo Island.
Yeah, so 70 days later, 35 miles, which I didn't realize they found her in Canada.
Yeah, Amherstburg, Ontario.
Two polite fishermen.
Yeah, hey, too nice. Oh, shucks. She seemed like she must have been a nice lady if it wasn't for all the, decomposing and whatnot there. Sorry, I turned them into Fargo people.
The Canadians are rioting right now.
So 35 miles from where they allege her body enters the water. So this was devastating, right? She's the backbone of the family, and that backbone is ripped out. Just like, God damn it. That was
like a Mortal Kombat fatality.
Like a fucking Jesus. So,
somebody ripped out my backbone.
God, why did I have to? Such a visual. Jesus. Anyway. So let's get into the third person that Michelle and the family hires to look into Joanne's disappearance. This person is named Scott Lewis, and he's a PI. And what does he do? He just gets in a boat with Michelle, and they just ride the 35 miles down to Armhurst. And it really puts into perspective, like, how long this freaking journey would have been, you know?
Sorry, I'm still laughing about the backbone ripping out of
the So to him, the thought of the body, like, drifting down the stream 35 miles was a little bit of a stretch. I wouldn't say completely impossible. To me, it's just more impossible that that she wouldn't have been found in that area. What Michelle and Scott surmise is that she was most likely dumped somewhere closer to, like, Detroit, right?
Do you want to also – the reason that they say this is because of her, the way her lungs – the condition of her lungs.
Oh, yeah. Let's, right? Yeah, go for it.
So they when they find her, she doesn't have water in her lungs. They say it's a dry drowning, which I've heard happens.
That's very unlikely. Something I've never – I don't – that just, to me, that makes no sense. Sounds like an oxymoron.
It happens to kids, apparently. I've heard when they kids are swimming all day, apparently they get lungs, they get water in their lungs, and then at night is kind of like, because they've been swimming all day continuously, their lungs are taking in water little by little, and then at night the effects of them drowning happens. That is what they consider a dry drowning. So that's, I don't understand.
Fucking terrifying.
Yeah, yeah. It's happened to a few kids where they swim all day and then at night they don't wake up because they have water in their lungs from swimming all day. But yeah, so that's what I know as a dry drowning. But also during the autopsy, they said that she had bruising on her left shoulder, and the family believes that it's because of her purse, which also coincides with the ripping of the purse. The purse was ripped.
Oh yeah. That's another thing we'll post is, like they say that there was no sign of a struggle, yet her purse is torn as if, you know, there was a struggle.
And his argument to why they don't think the rip has anything to do with the struggle is infuriating.
Oh dude, it's so stupid, right? They said that it's not where the strap would be. Fuck off. Like,
did you see that?
Okay, yeah, it's not where the strap would be, but the fact that
it has flaps. It has little flappies.
Dude, that purse was like a frilly 17th century dress with, like, layers and layers. It was mad frilly, right?
It was like someone like a purse snatching. You don't just go for the strap, you go for the fucking the bag itself, because a strap is going to tear.
Dude, so stupid. Yeah. And then
obviously never watched Aladdin.
Picture this. From the way she was dressed, she drives a Lexus. I don't know any woman who would, whether you have money or not, that would wear a tattered purse like that. She wouldn't.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And Michelle has the purse. She says that they gave her back the purse after they were done using it for their shitty investigation. She was like, this is her brand new designer purse. We get it. You're rich. Okay.
yeah, they're rich. Did you, I don't know if you guys noticed, but I noticed their really expensive, Marantz stereo that was just collecting dust back there that I wish I could contact her and buy.
Oh no.
It's a vintage stereo that they had right next to the purse. It was just dusty as hell. It goes for at least probably $400 if it works. Just chilling there. Wish I had it.
Yeah, they seem a little privileged. But once they do find her body, right, there's a lot of weird things. Like, everything's in pretty good quality. It doesn't look like she fucking walked her ass into the – it just looks like she was placed there. Like, there's no – all the damage is, like, superficial to, like – it can all be explained by her just being in the water. It's nothing – the only thing they find is – some bruises on her arm, right?
They find her keys in her jacket pocket, I think.
The daughters say that she never zipped anything up, which is a weird stance to take. I don't zip up.
Yeah, and
coats.
Also there was something else about another set of keys that we find out in the local segment that they did. What was that? I didn't really fully understand
it. Like they were in, they disappeared from evidence and then showed up again or something.
Something.
So 6 weeks prior to this event happening, Michelle made a comment in the local documentary that the spare keys to the Lexus had gone missing from their house.
Really?
Yes. And then shortly after her mom went missing, the keys just magically showed up at the police station with no documentation of, you know,
how they got there.
Holy like who crap, brought them dude, in.
So and that
maybe it might be the cousin who's a fucking cop. Okay. We got a lot more to talk about, guys.
So that you know, might that's explain. One of those things because like I don't know if any of you guys have turned in.
That does explain it perfectly, actually.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is, I don't know if any of you guys have ever turned in anything to the police department as lost or found, but it's not like you just go in like, hey, like I found the keys to a Lexus, or hey, I found a wallet, and they're like, oh, thank you very much. Like, no, they get your information in the event that it becomes evidence in a crime.
Right.
So it's funny that these keys just showed up without any info of like who accepted them into the lost and found, who brought them in.
That makes like, so much sense. So somebody stole the keys while she's at church, goes into her vehicle, waits for her, unlocks the door, locks it again, so that when she gets in, it totally makes sense. She gets in the vehicle, she hits the panic button on her keys that she has and is like, help, but it stops, and then they drive off, and then they come back. That, to me, makes a lot more sense than her drowning.
Cousin Tim... We'll get into Cousin Tim.
He's sus.
But Cousin Tim is a cop, and we still got a lot to talk about. One thing the third PI brings up is that, who fills their gas tank if they're just going to go kill themselves? He's like, She's like, sure,
considerate suicidal person.
If she fills the gas tank and then she goes into her garage and closes everything, sure. If she fills her gas tank, she goes and drives somewhere and shoots herself, sure. But just to, like, go down the street and walk into the water doesn't really make sense. So there's no time of death because she was so badly decomposed. He says it might have been drowning, but also that she could have been dead before entering the water. And that's super weird because the local doc says that she died of a dry drowning, that she did have water in her lungs, but I guess it was not that much. So that's a weird inconsistency with Unsolved Mysteries and some other information we learned.
There's a lot of inconsistencies, actually, that we're finding out in this after doing all the research.
Yeah. The autopsy defines the cause of death as indeterminate, which means they can't decide if it's a suicide, homicide, or an accident. The bruises that we talked about, he definitely says that they were anti-mortem, which means before she died. Two things that were missing and I don't think ever found that Joanne would have always had with her were her rosary and her cell phone.
Yeah, and those were never recovered. Still to this day, they don't know where they are.
Yeah. Her shoes were intact. She still had jewelry on. Michelle basically thinks she was abducted. And they have this fucking clip of this cop at the deposition because the family sues. So you have a bunch of testimony of all these cops talking about how they investigated the crime. And there's this pussy ass cop. And they asked him if he think it's weird that the car was there and then it wasn't there. They asked him if they thought this was like an odd turn of events.
What did he say?
He just says no. And he's like squirming like a fucking 10-year-old. Like he's such a fucking pussy, this guy. No. Pissed me off. Like a little kid. Who you caught doing something not terrible, but like just like kind of, wrong. Yeah. The cops asked Michelle who would want to hurt their mom. And she has several ideas. The first is her father. He was very toxic, I guess verbally is what they make it seem like. And after 25 years, they got divorced and, he was not happy apparently, but he was, he declined to be interviewed by the private investigators and from, I guess the info and possibly alibis that they could figure out. The guy says that he wasn't involved. The investigator is pretty sure that he wasn't involved. Also, John, Brother John, who we talked about, John Matuk.
Yeah.
He was just a shitty-ass businessman. I guess he just, like, spent his, like, earnings unwisely. But it was also the housing crisis.
Here's the thing. So Netflix paints him as a failed businessman, but they failed to state that by the age of 29, he ran a multi-million dollar company that bought contaminated land, cleaned it up, and then resold it for a profit.
Oh, that's really cool. That is cool.
So it's
funny, like, the way that they light him, they kind of, like, do it a little darker. They kind of make it seem like he's nefarious a little bit. And it was really funny. One of the comments that he made was that I can't help if I owe people money. And then Adeline is watching, my oldest daughter, she's 10. She's watching this episode with me and listening to this man say how he can't help that he owes people money and that if those people wanted to do something bad to his sister. And then Adeline goes, except you can pay them. My 10-year-old daughter figured it out.
Oh, so she knows how debt works.
So yeah, he owed a bunch of people money, but it was 2009, around the 2009-2010 was after the recession, you know, the financial crisis and stuff. So everybody was hurting. So yeah, but yeah, they do kind of make him look like a shadester, right? And he was very, very close to his sister, so it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, they were the closest. So they actually, we find out there was actually some family drama going on between Joanne and John versus the rest of them, right?
So basically, it's not out of the realm of possibility that some high-up dude that he owed money to would get back at him by killing his sister because that was the person that he loved the most. But yeah, the family did have a lot of fucking drama. And they go into it a little bit in the episode. You know, they talk about the reason why the family isn't happy with each other and stuff.
Do they?
Yeah, they do.
Do they discuss how the mom left him a $20 million estate to be split between the five of them and two of them felt like they were shortchanged?
So yeah, they do talk a little bit about the inheritance, them splitting it up, but they don't get into like specifics. They just say that there was drama over the split of the inheritance in the episode. So another thing I want to talk about is this argument that happened that the daughters witnessed. Apparently, Joanne got a call from Tim Matuk, the cousin who's a cop at the time. And he basically
does he say?
Well, we don't know, but the daughters basically say that she was saying stuff like, how'd you get my number? Like, you know, you cause nothing but trouble. And she seemed scared after she got off the phone, and she apparently told Michelle, she's like, if something happens to me, look to Tim.
Yeah, that was weird, right?
That's freaky, right? Like, what the fuck?
In one of the five-part local documentary thing that we'll link in our profile.
Bio.
Talks about how she says to one of the daughters about like how Tim made a comment about like, if I needed to get rid of you, I know just the people to do it and no one would ever find you.
Right. Yeah. And of course, Tim's side of the story is that, he called her because he was mad that she had been telling people that Tim was the reason for all of his cousin John's, financial woes, that he was the shady one screwing everything up. So Tim called and said, why are you telling people this?
Yeah, like, you stop spreading gossip.
I miss you, and we haven't talked for a while.
Yeah, and she said, and apparently she said, I don't want to talk to you. And then John told him not to go to the funeral because of all the drama in the family. They just decided that he shouldn't go to her funeral, which also makes it look mighty shady.
Oh, super shady. It's like, why wasn't Tim there?
And it also plays right into the thing about the cops not being super transparent with the investigation, being it that one of their own might probably had something to do with it, you know? Who knows? So apparently Tim and John have bickered, you know, throughout their lives. You know, they didn't always have a good relationship, and Joanne would sort of act as the mediator. And that could have just been as simple as this, as what happened. Like she got in the middle of something that was, you know, too big, too serious. And, Tim killed his cousin. I don't know.
Maybe she knew a little too much about what.
Michelle tells the camera right down the barrel. All I know is she had a fear of him and now she's gone. But the cops spin this whole family drama thing as being stressors that would lead her to suicide. So that's kind of annoying. But also, yeah, Catholic, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think that – I honestly think she was such a devout Catholic. I mean, this woman went weekly to prayer meetings for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like the type of person that would – were they daily? I thought they were
practically
weekly.
She, yeah, it's well, not weekly or daily, but – the sister was saying, like, she wasn't the normal Catholic that just went on Sunday. She would go multiple days throughout the week.
Yeah,
she went
multiple times. Yeah, that doesn't
sound
like
it was Bible study, prayer group.
Is going to kill themselves.
So basically, they sue the police. They're like, you guys didn't do your job well. And it gets dismissed. Like, you know, the U.S. District Court judge also stipulates, as it says at the end of the episode, there are disputed facts in this matter that are very disturbing and to this day remain unresolved. And, you know, that's the high court. So it's just that's like
kind of where it's left, right?
Yeah. Some more stuff I do want to talk about is this wine store story that we get from the documentary.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We definitely need to talk about that.
This is another one of her brothers, right? I didn't get his name. Fuck. What's the other brother, the bald brother that we meet in the local documentary?
You know what? I don't remember, but it's one of the other brothers. You're right. So there's five. She has four other siblings.
Yeah, he's another Matouk, and he, I guess, is the one that's currently running the wine store that their parents owned. Right, because they say that the family owned the wine store, and so there's this wine store story. Michelle says that she was really scared before this conversation, and she was terrified after the conversation. Apparently, she was driving with her mom, and her mom ran into the store to talk to her brother, who she hadn't talked to in a while. The brother said it was a simple conversation, and that basically she was telling her brother not to trust him, that Tim was bad and shady and all this stuff. And, he says he was like, why? He's like, I'm not in business with him. Like, he's just my friend, you know, like we're just family members. Like, I don't see the problem of associating with him. And he made it seem like it was a very civil, combative, but just one sided. Like she was like, don't talk to Tim, blah, 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 blah. And he was completely normal. But that's definitely not what Michelle says. Michelle says that she came out and she was fucking terrified.
She was so spooked that all she would say is she wouldn't talk about it and that she needed to go to church and pray immediately.
Fuck.
That's how disturbing the conversation was.
And the biggest thing that Unsolved Mysteries leaves out that I kind of wanted to leave for the end of this episode is the Paul Hawk story.
Yes, this is what I want to get into.
Now, Paul Hawk is a witness of sorts. He saw something very crazy, and when he learned that Joanne was missing, he went to the cops, and they got a statement, and they just didn't do a goddamn thing with it. That's it.
Yeah, the chief that we see, they say the chief, which I'm assuming is the guy we see on video with the mustache.
Yeah, that asshole.
He said he was uncredible.
Yeah,
which they don't give a reason why. They just said we didn't believe him
or something. Yeah,
and we're like, well, you need to give me more than that. Like this person said, this person Paul Hawk says that he claims to have seen. He drove by the church that evening and saw her sitting on the embankment, kind of like head down, and police officers. He even gives descriptions.
Did he say they were police officers? I thought he just said there was two cars parked illegally.
I thought he said police officers. Maybe I just put my mind to it. Maybe I need to go back and watch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think they were. He said, so she's sitting over slumped, and there's two tall men around there, and there's two cars parked illegally in the street. And one of the men just waved him through.
And maybe that's why I thought that he was a police officer was because they waved him through.
Once he goes and tells the cops and learns more about Joanne and sees a picture of Tim, he's like, that's the fucking guy.
That's him. And he said he went to the cops twice.
Yeah.
They said that he just couldn't get it. He's like, I couldn't like stop. Like something's up. And he went twice to them and that they told him, they basically just like said he wasn't a credible witness.
That's it.
And don't give any reasons why. They just say we don't believe him.
Yeah. It's really weird. And it's just like, I don't know. Like even if you're a fucking cop, are you that close with your homies where you're just like, oh man, you know what? My cousin's kind of an asshole. I'm going to murder my cousin. You guys got my back? You know?
It's weird. That is weird.
But apparently, like Dan said, and what they say in the documentary, that he threatened her once, saying that he knew the exact right people to take care of her. But of course, when asked if he'd ever threatened her life,
He says, of course.
Of course I didn't.
Of course he's going to say no.
Yeah.
I think he's going to like just
fold right there. Of course I did.
They talk about how loving and close his family is. And, you know, even if your cousin was kind of annoying, you think he would go to the funeral. It's weird. And it's like, did the rest of the family? But did the rest of the family know about this drama? Like, would it have been weird if he was there? You know, I guess we don't have enough information.
So I did want to talk about a few things. Like I said, there was a discrepancy issue. So there's lots of discrepancies with it comes to the cops and their timekeeping. So
yeah,
the first check happened at 8:58. The second check on the car happened at 9:58, an hour later, by two different police officers. Apparently, according to the daughters, the police arrived at 9:24.
Yeah.
They say this because one of the daughters says that as soon as the cops came, she looked at her phone to check the time. And she says that the cops arrived at 9:24, which also coincides with the fact that the Coast Guard was notified at 9:30. So also backing up the fact that the cops arrived was the fact that the daughters immediately start calling the mom. So calls begin, and they have the call records, like you said. At 9:29, the calls begin from the daughters to the mom trying to figure out, where are you? Coast Guard is also launched at 9:38. But the police also have multiple different discrepancies within their records, saying that one cop says he got there at 10:30.
Yeah.
The other one said he got there at 9:30. So
I tend to trust the Coast Guard. It seems more official, I do too. Right?
Yeah, like, 100%.
Yeah.
Because – yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So,
and their records say that they called the Coast Guard like around 10:30 or some shit like that, right?
Yes, but like the Coast Guard records say 9:30. So 100% their time. The police has some they're just all over the place. We can see that they just botched this investigation from everything. The time, the simple pulling of fingerprints on leather. Like, I mean.
Simples, yeah, yeah.
Simple things that are just like adding up. It's like the police are definitely need to be looked at a little bit closer. Also, there was a kind of a throwaway line that kind of happened where in the local documentary where they say that Joanna was supposedly meet with the FBI in the weeks coming up to her disappearance.
Yeah, and the FBI couldn't.
When they contact the FBI, their statement says they can either confirm or deny a meeting with Joanne.
It's like, wouldn't that help their – I mean, well, I guess we wouldn't know about it, right? They wouldn't tell the reporters. But
to me, if it's like – if they did meet, they could say that. But if they didn't, they could say, we can't confirm or deny it. Like, you only say can't confirm or deny when – I feel like when you actually did it and you just don't want to admit it.
Yeah. You just say no. Why would we talk to a church lady? It'd be easy.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have the should I read the official statement that Tim Matuk provided for the document
for
the local news story?
Read it. Read it.
Okay, let's see. On a very tragic night in 2010, when Joanne went missing, I was on duty working Michigan State Police Narcotics Task Force in Warren, Michigan. My location that night has been verified and confirmed by the testimony of Michigan State troopers and corroborated by cell phone records. After a lengthy 5-year lawsuit, not one but two federal courts dismissed the case against me. Any allegations connecting me to the death of Joanne are untrue and false. I feel like he's got that. I feel like he's got that saved, like copy paste. So because he's got to use that a lot.
100%. Because we also didn't hear from him from Unsolved Mysteries people. So I'm sure he sent that same excerpt to them.
And I wonder if Paul Hawk, what skin does he have in the game? Right.
Right.
I mean, they say
it feels like nothing.
They say that the town is tight knit, but like, I mean, how tight knit? I want to know more about this, Paul. I want to know.
I do too. Background. Maybe we should reach out to him and see if he'll talk to us.
That would be awesome. But what a scary thing to see. Yeah, he explains that he just explained a heavyset woman slumped over on the bank, and two men.
Waving him through,
and two cars parked illegally. I don't understand why that's not in the episode, the Unsolved Mysteries. Because
I heard that they had time constraints, but
that's dumb. This documentary that we watched was 30 minutes. the episode I took notes on was 45, 48 minutes, something like that.
Yeah, that's true.
I wonder what. Yeah, that and the man in the scarf, I think, are the two things that if you watch the episode beforehand, I think are pretty interesting. The man in the scarf is most likely has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I don't believe eyewitness testimony a lot anymore.
Well, there's not usually a man running down, it wasn't like a sidewalk, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
It's really interesting. I hope this gets solved. I hope somebody goes down for this. If it really is just small town cops like backing each other up, it's like, who fucking cares? Like, what does he have on them? Is he paying them off? I mean, it's a wealthy family.
Yeah, maybe.
Multi-millionaires. I mean, not like the fucking.
There was some drama, right? So the family drama that happened was that John and Joanne were kind of like saying that they got gypped out of the rest of the family's money, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was them specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were kind of in it together and everyone else didn't like them, maybe.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, that was the feud, was that John and Joanne felt that they were shortchanged in the transaction of the will because who is it, Jim or John? The oldest brother was the executor of the will.
It's annoying, especially when it's that much money. Like, just fucking split it. Jesus. We're all going to fucking eat tonight. Like, Jesus.
It's like $4.5 million per person. Like, that's enough.
Mm-hmm. Unless, like, one of the kids was just
a douche.
Or Rosemary Kennedy, and she's just been locked in the mental asylum to be forgotten about.
Right, but this is not the case with these people.
Did I get that name right? I think I got that name right, Rosemary Kennedy. Did you know about that? Did you know?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, they just wrote John F. Kennedy's sister. It was just like, she was mentally ill, and they just gave her a lobotomy and threw her. Actually, she probably wasn't even mentally ill. She was probably just opinionated. They gave her a lobotomy, and she just sat in a fucking hospital. And she lived way long. You know, that it's like the curse hit her in a different way. She died very old, but she didn't have a quality of life. It's just, yeah, it's really sad. That's a fun story. Anyway, this was a really good one, man. I really feel like we had to put some hats on and
I got really excited for this just because there was so many, like, it's a lot more nuanced than the Unsolved Mysteries segment goes.
Yeah. I think this case is, I don't know. This isn't their best episode. It's a really good case, but it's not.
I feel like this is solvable. I feel like definitely it was good that they highlighted it.
Mm-hmm. Because we wouldn't have talked about it, right?
No, not at all.
Yeah, thanks so much for hanging out with us, guys. Yeah. We'll be back next time to cover the stolen kids of the New York area, which is another really weird case.
Is this another child train?
No. I mean,
yeah, we might.
I don't think so, but maybe.
That might be the sequel. I don't know. But
the modern child train.
The next episode is extra sad because it's just like babies taken from parks for no reason. But yeah.
Cue that harmonica.
Yeah, we should get a harmonica in here while I tell the story just for old time Unsolved Mysteries. Well, no, this isn't a Lost Loves, though. This is like truly like horrific, like kidnapping. Yeah, missing persons. For sure, missing persons.
I was going to say about like that one lady that was kidnapping children by like just driving up and like opening the door and like, you want a candy and a puppy? Like, come on. Like, now go, Cletus. Go, Cletus. So the one that ran up the orphanage.
Oh, yeah. That lady sucked. Literally, that lady was stealing kids
from
to
people.
Resell them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess stolen babies are like Unsolved Mysteries. Unfortunately, that's like a genre of
case. It's a subgenre.
Yeah, it's a subgenre of Unsolved Mysteries case. Thanks so much for listening. Give us a rate and a review. Give us a comment.
Only if it's nice.
Give us a comment if you find. Give us a comment if you find anything new. We love to keep talking about these cases. Oh, did we talk about how there's an Alonzo Brooks update?
No, is there an update on Alonzo Brooks?
Sort of. It's not like, it's just like more information. But it's really cool. On the Netflix Instagram, they like posted like a 30-second video and it was like, update. Like, I would consider it the first update.
Nice.
I wonder if they've added it to the fucking episode, the little 30-second sting at the end.
Maybe.
I don't know. We need to go back.
But basically what it is they found out that there was another party very close to the same area.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do remember. Yeah. So they're looking into the other party that happened.
They want to know if there's anybody anybody who went to that party that could help them out to come
forward.
So
I guess they got some leads, I guess.
Maybe there might have been some party hoppers.
Getting warm.
Yeah. I wonder if that's added to the episode. That's interesting.
You gotta go back and see.
Yeah.
That's the cool thing about streaming now is like you can always add to it and update it, and we wouldn't even know because we'd already watched it unless we watched it again.
Yeah. They should. Well, for something like this, they should do that. It's not exactly George Lucas adding CGI to Star Wars movies. You know, it's like it's just more information.
Bring in the digital Yoda.
Oh, I hate this. It's a perfectly good puppet in Phantom Menace, and they're like, well, it's gotta match the shitty CGI one from Attack of the Clones. Assholes. So fun watching. So we were watching those documentaries about those prequels, and it's just George Lucas like being so excited about the technology that you're like, you almost forgive him. Because they're really entertaining documentaries.
In Phantom Menace, they did use a puppet?
Yeah. Yeah, because he doesn't lightsaber or anything. But if you watch it now, like if you watch it on Disney Plus, it's they remastered it already. They put a CGI Yoda in there. But I digress. Anyway. If you want to talk about Star Wars, you can also hit up our Instagram as well. But anyways, thank you, Eli. I've been David, and of course, the lovely Daniel Benavidez.
Yeah, in case you want to Plum shit Dan. On us on a review, that's who we all are, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm now Plum Dan instead of Road Dan.
Yeah.
Did you change your bio and your Instagram?
No. Maybe.
And then a couple weeks, we'll get back to season 5 of the original Robert Stack hosted Unsolved Mysteries. Yeah, so thanks a lot anyway. For every mystery, there's someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone is listening, and perhaps that someone is you. Have a great week. Good night.
Ciao.
Wear a mask.